Good morning. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. We're live in the Allstate Studio, 7th floor of the Trib Tower. Here till 5 a.m. It's Monday, and that means we're going to review the movies on the Monday Morning Movie Reviews. Eric Childress and Colin Suter join me every Monday morning to talk movies, and Eric sticks around. We talk box office as well. So we got all that coming up. And our phone number and text number, 312-981-7200. 312-981-7200. That's our phone number. And we've got our movie reviews, and my dad's going to call in and tell a joke, and so much more. We're also going to talk about the Grammys and go through the winners and the losers and the highlights and what were your favorite moments and your favorite performances and all that cool stuff. So we'll talk Grammys a little bit later on. But right now we got to get to the movie reviews, and let's welcome Eric Childress. Hey, Eric.
Hello.
And Colin Suter. Hey, Colin.
Hello there.
How are you?
All right.
Okay. Well, why don't we start, Colin, why don't you start us off with the Oscar-nominated short films? As you know, right around this time every year, they release the films that are nominated for short films so that people can check them out and see them before the Academy Awards are handed out. And you saw the Oscar-nominated short films. Now, are they playing just at the Landmark?
No, they're playing at quite a few places, actually. They are playing at the Landmark Century. The animated and the live-action shorts are playing there. Those are also playing at the River East and out in Barrington as well.
Oh, okay. All right.
And the documentaries are not as widely exposed because they have to separate them into two programs because they're so long for short films.
Right.
And one program will be playing Saturday morning at 11:30 a.m. at the Music Box, and then the other program will be playing Sunday at 11:30 a.m. at the Music Box next weekend. So next weekend is your last chance to see the documentary shorts in the theater. But two of the actual shorts are playing on Netflix.
Okay.
For the documentaries. So I'll get to those in a minute. So for the live-action shorts, kind of a mixed bag this year. Usually is, but this year I thought there were like two that I really liked a lot. One that I think is pretty good, and then the other two I'm not so crazy about. The movie I'm rooting for is a film called Sing. And it's about a girl who joins a chorus at her school. And, you know, she's new at school, and the chorus teacher tells her, don't actually sing because we want to win this state competition coming up, and it'd be better if you just not sing because she's not that great. And then she learns that other kids have been told the same thing. And the payoff at the end is enormous. I mean, it is so great. And the kids in it are really good. It's just it's a really wonderful short film. So that's what I'm rooting for. The other one I'm kind of rooting for as well is a film called Time Code. And it's about a female security officer who finds a tape of one of her coworkers on another shift who's like he's like filming himself dancing and practicing his dance moves in front of the security cameras when there's, you know, nothing but downtime, which there usually is. And they kind of start this video relationship with one another that is really something special. And I think those are the two big crowd pleasers in this group. And usually the crowd pleaser wins. Usually the English language crowd pleaser is the one that takes home the Academy Award, but there are no English language films this year in the group. So, my guess is it's going to go to one of these two. And then Enemies Within is a really good film about an Algerian with a police record who is applying for French citizenship and, you know, faces a long line of questioning to the point where he's sort of asked to name names. And that's a good one. It's very talky, but very well acted. And then the other two, one is called, where is it? La Femme TGV. It's about a lonely woman who finds a letter from a driver of a train who drives by her house every day, and they kind of start writing to each other the old-fashioned way and getting to know each other. It's okay, but it leaves a lot of questions at the end. And another movie called Silent Nights, which is kind of timely I mean, at least in terms of its subject matter, where a woman at an immigration shelter in Denmark, she falls for an illegal immigrant. And it's okay. The cast is likable, but it tries to cram way too much into 30 minutes. And so the payoff, the emotional payoff that it really desperately wants, really just doesn't work. Those are your short films. That runs over 2 hours, but it's just over 2 hours. The animated films are quite good. There's the Pixar one. There's usually either a Pixar or Disney in one of these. And this one, it's Piper. That's the one about the baby seabird who teaches itself to hunt and find shells in these big waves in the big ocean waves. That was a short film that showed before Finding Dory.
Right.
Really, I like that one quite a bit. I think it's really cute and could very well win. it's usually a good idea to bet Pixar or Disney in this category. Although last year was a big upset. But another one is called Pear Cider and Cigarettes. This is the longest one. This is about 35 minutes, and it's about a guy who goes to China to find his troubled alcoholic best friend and bring him home to Vancouver. It's kind of like a graphic novel in the way it's made, and certainly the most ambitious of the films. But the storyline can get a little weary after a while. It's pretty grim. And it kind of goes against all the other ones in this program. It kind of feels like a little jarring in tone compared to the other ones. So it's okay though. Another one is called, Blind Vaisha. And it's a fable. It's kind of a fable about a girl who was born with one eye that sees the past and one eye that sees the future. And so the present is a blind spot. And it's cool. It's narrated by Carolyn DeVernis.
Oh, awesome.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So it's cool to see her doing stuff again. And it's kind of like a picture book quality to it. I think Neil Gaiman fans will enjoy it. It's interesting. It's a good one. And then a really cool one, which is made by some of the people at Pixar, is called Borrowed Time, which I like to refer to as the Manchester by the Sea of animated westerns.
Jeez.
Yeah, it's a pretty sad story, but it's good. It's a guy who returns to the site where a mistake long time ago cost him his father's life, and it's just kind of revisiting that. And it's really good. And then finally, there is my personal favorite is a movie called Pearl, and it's 5.5 minutes, and it's very music video like. It's kind of just a music video, but it's really cool. It's about a girl who finds a tape recorder in the backseat of her dad's car, and all of a sudden, a flood of memories come back to her about how they, would travel around the country in this car together and, be musicians and everything. Now she's an adult and now she's a musician and living her life. And it crams a lot into 5.5 minutes, but I really loved the beautiful simplicity of it. And, so I'm kind of hoping that one wins, but it usually goes to Pixar or Disney. So, and then there's three other short films. There's three other animated short films that play with the program, but I didn't get to see them because they weren't on the screener. This is a kid-friendly program except for Pear Cider and Cigarettes, which is not kid-friendly, but they put a disclaimer at the beginning of that film to tell the parents to take their kids out of the theater right now, and it's that's the last one on the program.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Okay. So that's the short subjects, live action and animated. We got to take a break here for the news, and we come back. Colin, you can jump into the documentaries.
Yeah.
Okay. Great. Hang on, Eric. Okay. And and Colin, hold on, and we'll come back. We got the news coming up here, and then we'll come back with more Oscar nominated short films. All the Oscar nominated shorts are available for you to see. If you're like a completist and you have an Oscar pool. And you want to get it right, then you might want to check it out. And it's playing in a few theaters throughout the city and the suburbs. We'll take a quick break. We got the news coming up next on WGN. Hi, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. Live in the Allstate Studio, 7th floor of the Tribune Tower. Welcome back to the show. It is Monday morning, and that means it's time for the Monday Morning Movie Reviews with Colin and Eric. And we'll also talk box office as well. And my dad's going to tell a joke because it's Monday. We want to start your work week off with a laugh, so it's a jokey time. And the Grammys were last night, and we'll talk all about that. Take your phone calls and your texts on your thoughts for the performances and the show itself. Our phone number and text number is 312-981-7200. You can also check us out on Twitter, at Nick D Show. Best way to stay connected is on our Facebook page, facebook.com/Nick D Show. All right, let's get back to the movie reviews. Before the break, before the news, Colin was telling us about the Oscar-nominated short films that are actually out now and you can see. Andy, welcome back, guys.
Thank you.
And Colin, you told us about the live-action shorts and the animated shorts, and now you can tell us about the documentary shorts. And like you said, these are a little bit longer, so the program is going to be played at the Music Box.
Yeah, in two separate programs. And boy, I got to tell you, this is the hardest category to predict of any category this year in the Oscars. This is the hardest one to predict because all five movies are fantastic.
Really?
I mean, yeah, really great stuff. So the one that might not win just because it bears too much resemblance to Fire at Sea, which is the feature-length documentary that's also nominated, is 4.1 Miles, which is sort of depicts the rescue efforts of a Coast Guard captain as he brings thousands of Turkish refugees off the Greek islands of Lesbos. So that one, you know, just kind of is very similar to a film that's already nominated for feature. So that's the one that might not win, but the topic is so prevalent to today that it still could win. In fact, there's two others that are also a big, but I'll get to those in a second. So this is program one I'm talking about. So 4.1 Miles is program A, I should say. And then another movie is called Joe's Violin, which is getting probably the biggest push from its distributor. It's about a 91-year-old Holocaust survivor who donates his violin to the Mr. Holland's Opus Foundation, and they find the right fit for every instrument that is donated. And when he sees which student inherits his violin, it's a big, you know, emotional moment. It's pretty great. And then the third one in that one is called Extremis. And this is one of the films that's on Netflix if people want to check it out. It's really impossible to watch this without getting tears in your eyes. It's about sort of the emotional toll that is taken by doctors and parents and, you know, their sons and daughters as their loved ones in the hospital are laying there hooked up to breathing tubes and possibly facing death. Mm. I mean, the moments that this film captures are just devastating. And it's really just heartbreaking stuff, but God, is it beautiful. So that's program A. And then program B is just two films. Both are like 40 minutes long, I think. One is called Watani, My Homeland. And this one also has a good chance of winning. It follows this Syrian family, a family of Syrian refugees making the choice to flee to Germany after the father disappears. And the movie follows their lives, you know, while they're starting over. And it's so epic in scope and for a short film like this. I mean, I think they followed them around. The filmmakers followed them around for 2 or 3 years. You wonder, God, why is it a short? This should be a feature, you know? And I don't think it would lose an ounce of power if it was a feature, which is about as high a compliment as you can give to a short film. And that film is paired up with The White Helmets. And this is the perfect film to pair it up with because it's about the rescue efforts in Syria by this group called The White Helmets. And they rescue people from the rubble after, you know, air raids. And there's a rescue in this film that is really powerful. And I think you're going to see some, you know, where are they now follow-up documentaries for a couple of years to come if people see this thing. And so you got three films that are about immigration and Syria and, you know, refugees and, you know, what's going on out there. And, you know, if one of these three films wins, expect this to be a big moment in the show, a big politically charged moment in the show.
Yeah.
But the other two, one of the other two movies wins. I mean, that's going to be pretty powerful too. I mean, this is a really strong category. It's so hard to pick predict what I think is going to win. My heart goes with Watani, My Homeland, just because of what went into it. And so I'm rooting for that one. But Joe's Violin could win. Any one of these could win, really, honestly. So.
Okay.
I'm not much help there.
Okay. And it's like you said, it's going to be playing at the Music Box, these two separate programs this weekend.
Yeah, at 11:30 a.m. Saturday and Sunday. And if people can't get to the theater to see these, they are going to be streaming online starting February 21st. They're going to stream them on iTunes, Amazon, Google Play, a bunch of streaming services. And if people want to figure out which one works best for them, they can go to shortstv.com, and that'll have all the information on that.
Shortstv.com, and they'll be available a week from tomorrow.
Yeah.
Okay. All right. Well, thanks, Colin.
Sure.
Okay. All right, Eric.
Yeah.
Why don't you you and Colin can handle 50 Shades Darker.
Oh, we can handle it.
All right. So, Eric, tell us about 50 Shades Darker.
Okay. Well, this is the second part in the ongoing trilogy of the adventures of Christian Grey and Anastasia Steele. We first met them in 50 Shades of Grey. When that film ended, they had broken up. And that's where they are at the beginning of this film. He apparently still has feelings for her. So he continues to send her flowers, though she's not too keen on accepting them. But it doesn't take 20 minutes into the film before they have a chance encounter at an art gallery. And basically resume their relationship. She seems willing to renegotiate the terms of the S&M contract that they signed in the first film, although we never get a repeat of that scene in this. They basically just get back together, and it's a little more loving. It's not quite as rough or experimental as we saw in the first film. But inherent in the title, it is supposed to be a darker time for these characters. And there is darkness represented in, I guess, three separate new characters brought into the film. We meet the woman who basically put Christian Grey on this path towards sexual excess, if you will. His dominant mistress, played by Kim Basinger, which is probably the most inspired casting decision in either of these films so far. We meet a former Anastasia of Christian's, who is still obsessed with him and is not too happy that she has been replaced. She's played by Bella Heathcote. And then there's also a case of a boss. Anastasia's new boss at her writing publishing company, wherever she works. And he has a fixation on her as well, and doesn't exactly take too kindly when discovering that she has a boyfriend. These are sort of the extent of the grasp of the representation of these characters. There's, as what we saw in the first one, there is very little in the range of competence in the story and in the writing. And even though the movie is directed by all people, James Foley,
yeah,
who's directed not just this one, but the third one as well, the upcoming third chapter, there's really nothing much in the way of even sort of visual gravitas to any of it. There's a masquerade scene that's very colorful, but that's about it. The one thing, one thing we've been taught about sequels in any fashion is that they get bigger and badder. And this film takes the one conceit of the original, of the first story, and basically just softens it. There are moments where a little bit of kink is brought up, but frankly, I saw much more interesting smut on Cinemax when I was growing up. So there's not even an interesting angle to it there. The performances, once again, are completely wooden. Even Dakota Johnson, even more so this time around, which I didn't even know if that was possible. The three new dark threats brought into the movie, two of them are basically just setups for the final chapter, and the third, and the Bella Heathcote character, is pretty much forgotten after introduced for about an hour, brought in for one scene that's quickly resolved and never heard from again. Even though I've said a lot, there really is very little to say about these movies, and I'm sorry, this one joins the rank of garbage that was the first film, and I can't even imagine where the third film's going to go from there.
Okay, all right, Colin, hang on, okay? Eric, hang on.
Yep.
When we come back, Colin will give his review of 50 Shades Darker, which is the latest in the 50 Shades franchise, I guess. All right, we'll take a break. When we come back, Colin will give his review, and we got more movies to review right here. It's Monday morning on 720 WGN. Hi, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. Welcome back. It's Monday morning. That means it's time for the Monday morning movie reviews. We will also talk with Eric about the box office, what were the big winners and the big losers this weekend. Before the break, we had Eric tell us about 50 Shades Darker, which I did not see. And now we'll welcome the guys back. Welcome back, guys.
Hello.
All right, Colin, what did you think of 50 Shades Darker?
Well, I didn't think it was possible for the 50 Shades of Grey to be dumber, but I was so wrong. Mm. Eric said he wasn't. He can't imagine where the third one is going to go. Well, they did manage to squeeze in a mini trailer in the end credits of the film. I don't know if you saw that, Eric, but
I didn't get that far.
Yeah, but I don't blame you. But there actually is a little trailer for the third one showing at the end of the film. And it looks just as terrible as this one. It's called 50 Shades Freed. So I guess she's freed from her slavery obligations or whatever. I don't know what it means. But anyway.
Does it take place in the Old West?
I don't know. Who knows at this point? But the story that's here is quite a mess, because the movie tries to squeeze in just kinky moments between these two every 10 or 15 minutes. But it's never like the transition between that and the plot, such as it is never really organic. On top of that, every scene of dialogue between these two gets off topic about halfway through, you know, just as like the conversation is getting even remotely interesting. Suddenly it's like, well, let's stop talking about that. Here, I have a surprise for you. Let's get my helicopter and I'll get, you know, show you. And it's like, wait, what? We were just getting, something was just happening there. Why are we, okay, fine. And then the movie tries to delve deep into Christian's psychological problems and his childhood trauma, and it's so bad. I mean, it's like it's straight out of Psychology for Dummies for Dummies. There's the scene close to the end of the film that is basically it's the series from The Room when the mother tells her daughter that she has breast cancer, and it's never mentioned again. And this movie has that moment, yeah. Except it lasts like three whole scenes. It's a ridiculous sequence that makes no lick of sense, doesn't add anything to the narrative, and is just completely preposterous and garnered so many unintended laughs from the audience when I saw it, as did the very end of the film, the big reveal at the end of the film that tells us another sequel is on the way. Like Eric keeps using the word garbage. Absolutely true. That's what this is. It's 50 Shades of Garbage, and we're going to get 50 more next year. So.
Now, there's two things I wanted to mention. One, Colin, you posted on your Facebook page.
As did many other.
As did many other people, but I saw yours. I saw yours first.
Yeah.
Can you tell everyone what hangs on the wall in this guy's apartment?
A framed poster of the Chronicles of Riddick. That is how boring this movie gets. Is like when you start paying attention to the blurry poster, you know, hanging up in one of the shots of one of the scenes towards the end of the film, and you go, "Wait, is that?" It is. It's a Chronicles of Riddick. We all like elbowed each other, like, "Are you seeing this?" Like,
yeah.
what?
Yeah, I mean, you know, Universal has a lot of movies they can choose from. You know what I mean?
Sure.
To put on the this guy's wall, but they chose that.
Yeah.
That's weird. Now, the other
a lot of questions.
The other thing that I have that I've read is that there's a scene in the movie where Dakota Johnson repeats a line of dialogue almost verbatim from her mom's movie Working Girl.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. Yep. And it's the "I don't expect you to get me coffee unless you're getting some for yourself," and it's like it's the exact same line.
Yeah. Pretty much. Yeah.
And we'll figure out the rest as we go along.
Right. Right. Okay.
Uh-huh.
All right.
Which made me wonder, because I wrote that, because I actually got, I was sitting down at the, not at the screening, but I went and saw this Friday afternoon, and that line came up. I got out of my seat and walked to the aisle and tweeted. I couldn't believe what I was hearing, because I couldn't figure out, I wanted to know, and no one told me, if that line was actually in the book, or if that was some sort of just weird throwout homage to her mom's movie that happens to be a title of a movie that could also be referred to as a hooker.
Right. 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 Now, I mean, my guess is that it was just put in there as like a, you know, as an homage to Melanie Griffith. It would, you know, I mean, it's the same exact line.
Yes.
So
right. Nobody's going to admit to reading the book and give you that answer, though. So,
we're going to have to trust. We're going to have to trust us on that one. Okay. All right. Well, that's there. You go. 50 Shades Darker. You guys loved it.
it's fantastic. Go see it, everyone.
Right, okay.
Great. Oh, love it.
Colin, tell us about the red turtle.
All right. Well, this is the first of two animated films we'll be reviewing tonight. And it's the latest from Studio Ghibli, which is the Japanese animation studio that was made famous by Hayao Miyazaki. He's responsible for discovering the talent behind this film, an animator named Michael Dudok DeWitt. And this is a film about a guy who is shipwrecked on a deserted island, and we never know where he comes from or what time period this is, or we don't know anything about him. This is very much a wordless film, and he tries to build a raft, using the trees that are on this island to get off the island. And the rafts keep collapsing, they keep breaking, and one of the reasons why is because there's a red turtle in the sea that keeps bumping into his raft and making things hard for him, but is trying to get his attention. Eventually, he gets to know more about this red turtle, and I'm going to stop right there with the story, because I think one of the wonderful things about this film is discovering the story as it goes along. And I know people could easily look at the trailer and figure out what happens, but I'm going to recommend not doing that, just because when I saw this film, I knew it was animated, but I had no idea what it was about, and I was really, I think it's such a lovely, simple story. It has this, it's kind of this beautiful fable that feels like the kind of story that is being passed down generations, like a bedtime story that's been passed down generations, kind of as a, almost like Kubo and the Two Strings kind of fable like story. And I love the choice of, you know, having no dialogue in the film. It's a brave choice, because there's, you know, viewers might have some questions about this guy and, you know, about other things. But the movie is just an exercise in visual storytelling that is more of a trend lately than I mean, not a trend, but I've been seeing, you know, elements of that in a lot of animated films over the last 5 or 6 years. There's The Illusionist, from 2010, Shaun the Sheep from last year, the Aardman film, was you know, devoid of dialogue. And you know, the opening sequence of Up, you know, that's the perfect example. So the red turtle is kind of, you know, it is not that unusual in that making that choice, as one would think, but it's one that I really admire. And the score, the film score that's there, it's a little overdone at times, but it is quite beautiful and enhances, you know, the feelings that you're supposed to feel when watching the film. So this is, I think this is a really wonderful film by a director who was kind of plucked from obscurity by Hayao Miyazaki, who discovered him and said, hey, you want to make a film for, he saw one of his short films and said, hey, you want to make a film for us? And he just said, okay, not having any idea in his head what it would be. But he had to come up with something because you don't turn down that kind of job offer. And I thought what he came up with was pretty great. So it was number 11, I think, on my top 20 list mm-hmm. from last year. It's mm-hmm. considered a 2012 film. It's nominated for an Academy Award. People should go see it.
Okay. And it's at the Music Box. But, okay, Eric, hang on. Mm-hmm. Colin, hang on. When we come back, we'll get Eric's review of The Red Turtle, and I will tell you what I thought of The Red Turtle as well. That's all coming up right here after the news, which is coming up next on 720 WGN. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. We're live in the Allstate studio on the seventh floor of Trib Tower here till 5 a.m. Steve Grzanich with the opening bell at 5. Steve Cochran at 6 for your morning drive. And, yeah, it's me, Nick DiGilio, and we're going to talk about the Grammys, which happened last night. And my dad will call in and tell a joke because it's Monday, and it's a jokey time. And right now we're in the middle of the movie reviews with Colin Suter and Eric Childress from eFilmCritic.com, RogerEbert.com, and more. And before the break, Colin told us all about an animated film called The Red Turtle. And Colin, you gave it a very good review.
Mm-hmm.
All right. And Eric, what did you think of The Red Turtle?
I'm also going to give it a very good review. I like this film very much, and I'm glad Colin stopped with describing the plot because that's pretty much how I saw it, too. I went into to this movie cold, didn't know much about it at all. And, you know, it's a movie that, you know, as the film starts and kind of develops through its first act, you kind of go like, oh, they're just kind of doing kind of an animated Castaway. And like Colin said, they're kind of taking a little cue from Zemeckis and keeping the dialogue to literally a bare minimum in this case. And then the movie starts to work a really kind of special kind of magic. It takes these turns in the plot and it kind of goes down these different routes and adds a little bit of, you know, sort of magical realism to the story. And, you know, and becomes, it kind of stops becoming a story about survival and it just becomes kind of a story about life. It's, you know, it's hard to talk about this movie to not spoil certain aspects of it. So I'll keep it very simple. You know, it's beautifully animated. It's a beautifully story, a beautiful story, the way it's told. I echo what Colin said about the score. It didn't bother me at all because I loved listening to it so much that after I watched the film the first time, we all got screeners of it back in December. I let it play again just to have the score on in the background because obviously I wasn't going to be bothered by the dialogue. Yeah, I think it's a beautiful movie. And if you get a chance to see it on a big screen, it's I can't imagine that that's not a fantastic experience. So I recommend it very highly as well.
Okay, I do too. It's terrific. It's just a beautiful, beautiful movie. And it goes places that I didn't think it was going to go. And I know that you guys we're all avoiding trying to give anything away. But it's just so beautifully animated. And I really, really appreciate the fact that there's no dialogue in it. I think that the story and how it develops and how it's told is very unique and original. I too love the score. I just think it's a beautifully animated movie. And, you know, I'm a fan of the survival genre as many people are. And I think this is a really good example of that, but it goes into a different territory as well. Yeah, it's called the Red Turtle. And we're being vague about, you know, giving things away. But here's what you need to know. It's great. It's really, really great. It's beautiful. And it's a beautiful piece of animated storytelling that I really, 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 really liked. So, and it's playing at the Music Box, and we all recommend that you see it. Okay. I have not seen it on the big screen, I think. Colin, have you seen it on the big screen?
Unfortunately, no.
Neither have I. I mean, I saw it on my TV. So,
yeah.
But anyway. All right. Let's go to another one, shall we? Continue on.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, Eric,
mm-hmm.
why don't you tell us about the Lego Batman movie?
Okay, well, this is an animated film that's anything but silent. This is a sequel, so I guess spinoff, of the very successful and the just absolutely fantastic Lego movie from a few years ago. This one focusing on basically the breakout character of that story, a little guy known as Batman. Once again voiced by Will Arnett, this movie focuses solely on Batman, who just relishes the idea of being the superhero that he is, saving the day in his battles with the Joker, here voiced by Zach Galifianakis. And, you know, but when he's done saving Gotham from all the dastardly deeds, he goes home to his lobster thermidor and anything prepared by Alfred, voiced by Ralph Fiennes, leads kind of a lonely existence. He doesn't really have anyone to share anything with. And then blow is kind of struck to his crime-fighting abilities when new police commissioner comes in, Barbara Gordon, and basically says that Gotham doesn't need the Batman, that the public just needs to band together, let the cops do their job, and he kind of starts to get phased out. Meanwhile, at a party, he kind of talks his way into adopting an orphan, Robert Grayson, who eventually we know will end up becoming his sidekick, Robin, voiced by Michael Cera. And the Joker is coming up with his own big plan to, just like in The Dark Knight, get caught and wreak tremendous havoc on Gotham. So all these storylines are going to collide. Everyone is going to come together in one way or another to knock down the forces of evil and basically potentially put an end to Batman's loneliness woes. And once again, though this movie is not done by Phil Lord and Christopher Miller, who did the first movie, the people that have taken over the reins for this clearly took a cue from what was so wonderful about the Lego movie. This movie is fast, frenetic, just incredibly, fantastically paced, and it is just full of big laughs. This movie takes takes no pains away from parodying and embracing all of the other Batman incarnations that we've seen over the years. It has no problems taking shots at the latest spate of really horrible DC live action films that have included Batman one way or the other, and it's a movie that is not just so frenetically paced and full of laughs, but like the Lego movie, it has a real heart behind it. The relationship between Batman and Robin is really sweet. The relationship with Alfred is really sweet. The problems of Batman, his loneliness problems, they take it actually pretty seriously, and pay it off in wonderful ways. The voice work once again is outstanding. Will Arnett, if Gob was not the role he was born to play on Arrested Development, it's certainly the voice of this tiny Batman character. I love this movie. Maybe not quite as much as the original Lego movie, because that was such a surprise when we first got that. But if they continue to make Lego movies like these two, we're in for a really great time of the movies.
Okay. All right, Colin?
Yeah, I like the movie. Not quite as enthusiastic as Eric or many of the other critics, but because I think the movie loses a little bit in the second half in terms of just laughs. I found myself not laughing quite as much in the second half, and found the sort of the fast, frenetic pace of the film, which worked for the first film quite well. I found it getting to be a little bit much, so I think it kind of loses a little steam towards the end in terms of the laughs. I echo everything else that Eric has said. This is a really funny movie. I'm glad that it takes shots at the live-action DC films, and I do like the relationships between the characters when the movie pauses on them for a while, which isn't often, but it does. It's really good. I much prefer the first film, just because I think that one of the strengths of the first film, aside from surprising sort of twist at the end, is the fact that it's the Lego world, and it goes kind of all over the place. It goes to different worlds in this Lego universe. You know, you got the Western scene, you got the fantasy headquarters where everybody congregates, and you got all, you know, different colors throughout. And this movie just kind of stays in superhero mode, which, you know, perhaps not surprisingly for people who know me, gets a little old for me after a while. I also think we need to have a moratorium on Jerry Maguire jokes. I think it's kind of reached my limit. Like, I think we need to think of another film to use as an example of movies that guys aren't allowed to, or cry at or whatever, you know, however the punchline is used. I think, you know, we could start thinking of another film, you know, starting now. But I like the movie. I still recommend it because I think it is really funny in the first half. The second half has moments, but not quite as much. But I'm still giving the movie a recommendation. So.
Oh, okay. All right. We got to take a break. When we come back, I'll tell you what I thought of it. And that's Eric and Colin with their reviews of the Lego Batman movie. Okay, and I'll tell you my review right after we take a break here on 720 WGN. Movie reviews coming up, and the box office as well. Welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. How are you? We're live in the Allstate studio on the 7th floor of the Trib Tower, and we are here until 5 a.m. Our phone number is 312-981-7200 for talk and text. And, so we are reviewing the new movies here on Monday morning, as we always do. By the way, it's Monday, so my dad will be calling in to tell a joke. But we got Eric and we got Colin here, and let's welcome them back. Welcome back, guys.
Thank you.
Okay, before the break, we've got Eric and Colin's review of the Lego Batman movie. Eric really highly recommends it, and Colin recommends it as well. And I also recommend it. I thought it was very, very funny. I think we all agree it's not quite as good as the first Lego movie. It is fast paced. It's loaded with a lot of jokes. The voice work is great, and it's, you know, it's really fun to look at. It's very colorful. The fun that it has with the Batman character and the sidekicks and the villains and all that stuff. You know, the basic Batman stuff is very funny. And they do take some cracks at the DC live action movies. And they also kind of pay tribute to all of the incarnations of Batman. You can kind of see that throughout the entire thing. And the voice work here is just great. I mean, the list of people that are in this movie, it's kind of ridiculous. Don't you guys think?
Yeah, and I'm kind of surprised Ralph Fiennes isn't doing a different character.
Exactly. There is another. Yeah, there's another character in there that he could have easily.
Yeah,
he could have.
Would have been fun.
Could have easily voiced. Yeah. But I, you know, I like the fact that, I mean, and it's, there's a bunch of dudes from like Comedy Central who just, you know, who work on Comedy Central all the time, who are all over this movie, and the guys who wrote it are of that vein, and the guy who directed it is one of the creative forces behind Robot Chicken, which is a really funny show,
mm-hmm.
and Seth Green has a voice, does a voice in the movie as well. And there's some of the people are really funny. Like, I thought Doug Benson's Bane was hilarious. It was hilarious, and I thought it was. And Jenny Slate can do no wrong. Obviously she does a lot of voice work because she's got that kind of voice. So everybody does really great work in it. And I love the fact that Billy Dee Williams is cast as Two-Face.
Yeah.
I thought that was pretty great. And, it's nice that Will Arnett and Michael Cera are back. You know, they're not brothers in this, but they're back together. And in the dynamic is a little bit different, but they're great. And I don't know. I thought it was very, very funny. And the audience I saw, we laughed a lot. There were a lot of big laughs in this movie throughout the entire film. And appropriate for kids. Adults will really like it, too. And like you said, Eric, if they continue to make Lego movies on this level, that's great. These are just a very entertaining, really well-made, very, very funny movie loaded with visual gags and jokes and all kinds of stuff. Now, the trailer for what's the next one?
Ninjago.
Now, I don't know what should I know what Ninjago is?
No.
Okay.
It's a thing. I've never followed it. I don't know what it entails, but it's a thing.
Okay. Well, the trailer's funny.
Yeah.
Yeah, the trailer's funny, and you know, so if like I said, if they're going the same route that the other two Lego movies are going, then that's great. So, yes, the Lego Batman movie, very entertaining, and we are recommending it. All three of us are recommending it. So that's two animated movies that we all have recommended.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, interesting. All right, cool. All right, we got one more movie to review, and it's another sequel. Yeah, it's sequel week here. So, Colin, tell us about John Wick Chapter 2.
All right, well, this is a sequel to the surprise hit from a couple of years ago. And one that had a much simpler and shorter storyline. You know, some thugs wreck an ex-hitman's car and kill his dog, and he gets revenge, and that's the end. that's it. That was last film. This one is John Wick, played by Keanu Reeves, being lured back into his profession. And so this is a pretty familiar storyline as well, of a guy who, you know, wants to get out of his profession but has to do one last job. And in this case, one of his bosses wants his own sister taken care of. Yes, with a gun. So John Wick reluctantly travels to Italy, right?
Yes.
I think? Yeah, to track her down. But then later learns, after he returns to the States, that there is a bounty on his life and every hitman in New York is out to get him. Mayhem ensues. Ian McShane plays the big boss. Lance Reddick plays John Wick's main nemesis in his own profession. And Lawrence Fishburne turns up later on as somebody who might be able to help John Wick. So there's a nice little Matrix reunion going on here.
Yep.
So like I said, the first film had a much shorter, simpler storyline. And I think that's kind of how I like my John Wick movies. You know, hour and 40 minutes, you're in, you're out. Not too much going on in the plot, but a lot of great action. And this movie, I think, gets a little too bogged down at times in its own plot. I think it just learning a little too much about John Wick, I think, isn't quite the way I want to go. But I still think there are some really great action set pieces in the film that kind of warranted a recommendation. It is still fun. It is still funny. I kind of wish the movie had lived up to the expectation that it sets up in the very opening scene, which all of which is great. The whole sort of opening prologue to the film is really terrific, but it opens with this great visual gag in the opening shot of the film that just suggests, like, oh man, we are in for a wild, unpredictable time that is going to be hilarious and great. And the movie doesn't quite reach that level of cleverness again throughout the film. The moment I'm referring to is almost Edgar Wright-like in its execution and its innovation. I think that what is here is better than your average hitman action film, the likes of which we see from lesser filmmakers and lesser actors. It is still fun. It is still John Wick just saying very little. You know, the dialogue in this movie is very sparse. So you are getting more of the same from the first film, but I kind of think maybe less would be more next time around. But I still, for, you know, an action adventure film, this is still, I'm still recommending it. So, yeah.
Okay. All right, Eric, Colin, hang on, okay? Because we got to take a break here. And when we come back after the break, Eric will tell you what he thinks of John Wick Chapter 2. And then I will tell you what I think of John Wick Chapter 2 on the Monday Morning Movie Reviews here on 720 WGN. Welcome back, everybody. How you doing? Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. We're live in the Allstate Studio on the 7th floor of the Trib Tower. We're here till 5 a.m. Steve Grzanch with the opening bell at 5, and then the great, the one, the only, my pal and yours, Steve Cochran at 6 for your morning drive. 312-981-7200 for talk and text. My dad's going to call in and tell a joke. We're also going to talk about last night's Grammys and talk about some of the performances that were good and all that cool stuff. Right now, though, we are in the middle of the movie reviews, and we are reviewing John Wick Chapter 2 with Keanu Reeves. Colin is giving it a recommendation. Right, Colin, you are recommending it.
Yes.
Okay, and let's find out what Eric thought of John Wick Chapter 2.
Well, I actually echo a lot of the sentiments that Colin has about this movie. The first John Wick film, I was more on the fence about than a lot of people who really sort of extrapolated this thing into the next big thing. I think that, you know, the first movie had some really solid action sequences, and in the middle of it weaved this mythology that just, you know, seemed like it was kind of in there and, you know, something that could have been expanded upon for the second film. So now here we are in the second film, and like Colin said, you hit the ground running with this prologue sequence that, you know, has car chases, fist fights, gun battles, just everything you can possibly imagine in the first 8 to 10 minutes of this movie.
And Peter Stormare.
And Peter, well, of course, yeah, playing a crazy Russian mobster that, you know, we're just typecasting at this point,
pretty much.
Right. The stuff in this movie is so over the top, crazy, beautifully choreographed, that it sets a bar for the rest of the movie that it occasionally lives up to here and there. Like Colin said, this movie is longer than the original film. And it has what, you know, should be a simple storyline, but that actually gets itself kind of needlessly complicated at times. The villain in this film, I think, is a big problem with the movie because I think he is ultra lame. And you would think that, you know, anyone who might be privy to this world that John Wick, this Mysterioso Harry Potter with Hitman world that John Wick lives within, that this guy would have heard about the carnage that this guy just inflicted on someone who messed with his dog in his car and may not want to draw him back into this world when he politely says, no, please don't do this to me. And then he exasperates the issue, and then it just gets worse from there. This movie does have some really terrific action sequences, particularly the fight scenes involving Common. I think the couple of their battles are really kind of wonderfully done.
How many stairs do they fall down?
Well, that's all Common does is stare. You know, that's his acting. That's his acting go-to is the, you know, tough guy stare.
No, but I'm talking about falling downstairs.
Oh, falling downstairs. Yeah, that's one scene where they fall downstairs. Is, you know, that's obviously a pretty, you know, comic effect, and it's pretty funny. And there's a moment where they're trying to hide their gunshots in the middle of a crowded area. That was also very amusing and very well done. I thought it was going to go into like Carlito's Weight territory there, but it takes a different spin. And I appreciated that stuff. The gun battles themselves, as much as I love a good choreographed gun battle, it just started to get kind of repetitive to me at times. Like, okay, you know, John Wick holds his gun close to his face and he shoots you in the leg and shoots you in the stomach and shoots you in the head. You know, that's kind of his signature move at this point. And like, there's this whole sequence in the catacombs that I think is too dark to really be appreciated. And I think that those sequences just kind of bleed into one another. So I'm recommending the film for that opening scene alone is almost worth the price of admission. There's stuff spattered throughout the movie that is really good. I'm getting very annoyed that the mythology of the film has somehow gotten even more obtuse in this. I think that it would have been more interesting to expand upon that. And even if it's just completely crazy and stupid, they didn't really do much more than what we saw in the first film. So it was just kind of repeating itself again. It does end on a note to complete his trilogy or however where this thing is going to go. And that's fine. But I don't think that these movies are the second coming that so many people are ready to anoint it with. It's good. It's fine. It's, you know, it's the kind of 3-star movie that you love to see on cable, you know, every now and again. But that's as far as I'm willing to go with it.
Well, I'm anointing it.
Yeah.
I loved every frame of this movie. And I thought it kicked massive amounts of ass from the beginning to the end. I thought all the fight scenes were great. The stuff between him and Common, fantastic. I thought there was a real great sense of humor in this movie. I think it tops the original, and I really like the original a lot. It's got some of the best choreography and some of the best shooting gun battles I've seen. Keanu Reeves just rules in this part. I love all the little details of this weird world, this weird assassin's world that uses old time telephones and and gets the contracts on an old computer and puts them through the tube. And I love that attention to weird detail. Like, what is this world? What's going on here? And I thought all that was great. And I just thought that I liked the villain. I thought the villain was good. He was a weasel, which is what a lot of villains are. And I thought there were just incredible sequences. Like you said, the opening sequence is fantastic. But I thought the catacomb sequence was great. The gun battles, all of the gun battles are great. The big sort of finale in the New York Museum with like a hall of mirrors, I thought was wonderful and really imaginative, and really great. And Keanu Reeves does stuff with a pencil in this movie that no one has done. They refer to the pencil incident in both movies, but you get to really see it in this one again. I just thought I was with it all the way, man. I think this is a phenomenal action movie. And from the get-go, I just was blown away by so much of it. I found so much of it to be really mind-blowing and really exciting. It's also very funny. There are some very, very funny moments in this movie. And I love the inclusion of Lawrence Fishburne. I thought that was a really nice little, oh, look, it's Morpheus and Neo together again. I thought that was great. Ian McShane just is having a blast here. And I thought there were a lot of big surprises in this movie. And I also thought that there were some really creative storytelling choices in terms of time period. Like, there's a sequence when he first gets to Rome, when John Wick first gets to Rome. He goes to, I always forget the guy's name. He played the roommate in Shaun of the Dead.
Peter Serafinowicz.
Yeah, that guy, he rules.
He's great.
He plays a sommelier who basically, you know, is going to give him guns. And then there's a tailor he goes to get his suit done. And what was the third? Because they cut back and forth between the three. But anyway, I thought it was interesting that they mess with time a few times in the movie to tell the story, and I think in an interesting fashion, and play with the time a little bit. So I thought the editing was really interesting, and the way they told the story was a little bit different, and those little teeny, those hints as to what's going on. I also love the fact that, like, evidently everybody in New York is a hitman. Because when he gets back and they've got the $7 million hit on him, There's like a 15-minute sequence where everybody on the New York street is trying to kill him, and they also do creative editing with that, where they're going back in time and back and forth and cutting back to what happened in the fight beforehand, like with the big fat dude that he has to fight with,
yes,
and all that. And I loved what they did with that. It was interesting, and it was playful, and I thought the whole sequence, as soon as he gets back from Rome, it's nonstop. It's just people trying to kill him. Constantly. And what is the body count in this movie? I mean, how many people does John Wick kill in this movie? It's going to be like 350 people. So I loved it. I can't wait to see it again. I think it's great. I wouldn't be surprised if it ends up on my list at the end of the year. I just thought it was great. I love from beginning to end, man. Action packed. I just thought it was phenomenal. So I'm one of those people, Eric. I fall into that.
You're in good company. There's a lot of people since the first movie. I mean, this became a little cult thing once it premiered at I think it was Fantastic Fest. I think where it first premiered. So
yeah,
people are down with it, and that's the reason it made a lot of money this weekend.
It did. I made $30 million, and it was packed when we went to see it on Saturday. It was packed. But I will say this: the first movie so surprised me, and I think that was part of why we all the people who love the John Wick movies, because we didn't expect to it. You know what I mean? I didn't expect. I mean, I want to say Keanu Reeves is a, you know, Keanu Reeves did like three of those like sort of martial arts, those weird martial arts movies. One that he directed,
yeah,
and those were okay. So I thought, okay, it'll be fine. You know, it'll be like that. And I was like, geez, this movie rules. But I thought they added to it. They made it more interesting. They did some playful stuff with the editing and the storytelling. And the action is on top, man. I loved it. Loved it. All right. What do we got next week?
Next week we got Fist Fight.
Right.
And we have visionary Gore Verbinski's A Cure for Wellness.
The Great Wall. Yeah.
With Matt Damon.
Yeah, which is weird casting.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. All right. Well, we got that to look forward to. All right, guys. Colin, thanks, man.
All righty.
Okay, you take care. And Eric, you hang on, okay?
Okay.
All right, we're going to take a break. We got weather, we got traffic. And then after the weather and the traffic, we will talk about the box office with Eric Childress. Big weekend at the box office, and we'll tell you all about it right after weather and traffic. And here's your weather right now. Welcome back, everybody. Monday morning, and we had our Monday morning movie reviews, and now we're going to talk box office. Eric Childress does a box office thing for movies, a box office analysis for movies.com. And Eric, tell everybody how they can see you on the TVs.
Yeah, every Thursday morning, the show is called Business First AM. It's on at 5 o'clock in the morning on WYCC, so set your DVRs. And I do a segment there with Angela Miles called Movies and Money, where we talk about the new releases of the week and any of the pertinent box office stories revolve around them.
Okay, and we're talking box office. Now, this was a pretty great weekend, Eric, for movies. A lot of the top three movies made a hefty amount of money.
Yeah, and all good in their own ways as well. I mean, varying amounts of money, obviously, but it's funny that the three sequels that opened this weekend made more in their first 3 days than the combined total of the sort of the four really bad sequels that we've had over the last month had made up until this weekend combined.
Well, see, this is what happens when you make sequels to movies that people want to see sequels
exactly.
to.
Exactly my point.
Yeah, like who the hell wanted to see Rings? Nobody wanted to see Rings. You know?
Nope.
And nobody's going to see Rings. So.
Yeah, and even as much garbage as the 50 Shades movies are, I mean, I walked out of the matinee screening on Friday, and there was a line of women waiting to get in.
Oh, yeah.
No men,
no
all women.
Yeah, yeah.
But, you know, it's a series that people... it didn't do as much as the first one, which we're going to get into, but it probably doesn't matter.
Yeah, yeah. All right, well, let's do it then. The Lego Batman movie with $55.6 million. What was that about where you thought it would be?
I actually thought it was going to be higher, frankly. The first movie, the Lego movie, did $69 million. And I thought if there was one character that people would have gravitated to have his own movie is the Batman character. So I thought it was going to do in the mid-60s. So I'm a little surprised that it didn't do quite as well, but its future prospects are pretty good. It's probably going to end up doing somewhere around 175, 200 million. So again, not as much as the first movie, and I don't know how to explain that entirely. I did see some write-ups about actually boycotting this movie because if you noticed who the executive producer of it is.
No, why am I missing?
It's Steven Mnuchin,
oh,
one of Trump's boys,
okay,
who's
right.
executive produced a number of Warner Brothers films over the years, including Suicide Squad, amongst others. I can't entirely buy that was so out. You know, that outreach was out there that people were going to deprive themselves of a Lego Batman movie because of an executive producer credit.
Yeah, no, no. That's
so, you know, but I'm a little surprised. I mean, good enough for number one should end up making its money back with no problem. But, I'm a little surprised.
Okay. Number two, 50 Shades Darker, $46.7 million. Now, the first one opened up much bigger, but everybody expected a drop off, correct?
Yeah, I mean, the first film was you know, clearly a phenomenon. $85 million did not exactly sustain itself after that. It actually has, I looked up the worst opening weekend, the final gross multiple of any film that's opened over $50 million. So that kind of shows that it's a front-loaded movie. This one, I thought it was going to open to about half of what that did, and that was pretty close, like $46 million.
Yeah.
So yeah, the drop off is there, and it clearly shows that people, even fans of the original movie, were not, you know, fans of the movie adaptation. Even though I think a lot of people say that the movies are actually better than the books because the books are absolutely unreadable.
Mm-hmm.
But there's still enough people out there who are either in it for the long haul, curious, or I don't know. I mean, I don't know who people are that actually felt the need to go back and see the second one after how, because I don't, even fans of the first one, I don't know, or fans of the series, I don't know who liked that first movie.
Yeah.
I've talked to a lot of people, and so I don't know. But again, this movie, it made another $100 million overseas already. So the budget was a little bit higher on this. The cast clearly renegotiated to get a little bit better chunk of the pie, but it's going to be in profit without question.
All right, and then John Wick Chapter 2 with $30 million. That's good.
Yeah, it's really good. It's really good. I mean, the first film the thing about the first film is that it was kind of right around the break even point as far as his budget is concerned. It didn't do huge business. It opened like $14 million, finished for like $43 million. But this thing became a phenomenon on maybe that's too strong a word, but it became a thing on DVD and on cable. That's where a lot of people discovered this movie, and like we've led the segment with, it was one of those movies that people wanted a sequel for.
Yeah.
They want, you know, the fans of this movie, you know, so like, no, I want more of this guy. I want more of this action. And they were delivered and they showed up. So good for the fans.
Yeah.
Actually showed up, because sometimes they get the case like, yeah, we want to see a movie, and then they wait till cable again.
Yeah.
So you actually went out and paid the movie to see the movie, did more than double its opening weekend, has a legitimate shot at $100 million if the word of mouth sustains and people get some of their friends to go see it. So this is good for Lionsgate and this franchise.
I got to tell you, it's so funny because when I saw the first movie, there were probably, I don't know, 12 people in the theater.
Yeah.
Saturday we went to a 4:45 showing at the Village Crossing in Skokie, and it was practically sold out.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it was packed, and it was just—it's just so weird. But so you're right; they did come out. I mean, these are people who probably saw the movie for the first time on cable,
right?
You know, and then just said, "Yeah, man." I mean, I was very excited about this when I first heard that they were making the sequel. I was like, "Well, I want it now."
Yeah.
So, and I loved it. Okay. So Split comes in at number four, $9.3 million.
Mm-hmm.
Biggest hit since what for Shyamalan?
Well, biggest hit since at least Last Airbender.
Right.
You know, not a hit, gross-wise. I mean, that movie was a tremendous bomb.
Yeah.
But it was the fifth $100 million grosser of his career. And as we know how that film ends, that gives very good prospects for what Shyamalan might have in store next. Yeah. And like we said, you know, the Blumhouse people, they figured out how to use this guy. It's like this guy wants to do sort of minimalist horror tales, not very good at them, sorry.
Yeah.
But you know, give him a $9-10 million budget and let him, you know, do his thing, and we'll make a lot of money off of him.
Right. So. All right, and number five, Hidden Figures, one of the big crowd pleasers of the year. It's doing mm-hmm. boffo business.
Yeah.
And again, one more time, number eight was La La Land, which is up to $126 million total.
And even more overseas.
Yeah,
and tremendous business overseas.
And it will continue to make money as we approach the Academy Awards.
That's right.
Okay. All right. What do you predict for next week? Do you think the Batman movie, Lego movie, is still going to be number one?
Yeah, I don't see any of the newbies, unless there's, you know, Fist Fight taps into something that, you know, in sort of like a central intelligence kind of way that people want to go jump to see this movie.
Yeah.
I have a feeling they won't. But, I think Lego Batman and maybe John Wick squeezes into number two. I think 50 Shades will drop off. Maybe majorly so.
Yeah.
So I'm thinking maybe Lego Batman, John Wick, and then maybe Fist Fight.
Okay.
I don't think Great Wall is like already made like over $200 million overseas.
Yeah.
Really an international hit. I don't see it doing particularly great here.
Yeah. I agree with that. All right. Well, thanks, Eric, and we'll talk next week.
Sounds good.
All right, Eric Childress. You can read him at RogerEbert.com, eFilmCritic.com, and every week we review the new movies and talk about box office on Monday morning. All right, we got to take a break. The news is coming up next on 720 WGN.